And welcome to the Gold Goats and Guns podcast for New Year's Eve 2021. My name is Tom Luongo, and we have a lot to talk about. It is episode 126, and I have with me my good friend from Buffalo and fellow Buffalo Sabres fan, Tom Mullen, whose show I've been a couple of times, and Tom's a fellow libertarian and a fellow traveler in attempting to try and make sense of the hell is going on over at the Fed, monetary policy and everything else. And that's what we're going to discuss today. Tom graciously sent me an article that he sent to his patrons a couple of weeks ago discussing the situation with the Fed, quantitative tightening. Are they really, you know, what's going on here? Is, you know, the why hasn't money multiplied? And we're going to get a little geeky and into monetary policy today. And we probably won't even agree at all because we don't know what's going on with actually what's going on. So Tom, thank you for taking time out today. Appreciate you being here.
Always my pleasure, Tom. Great to be here.
So let's get into it. So the thing is, it's funny. I read the article that you sent me, and it was an interesting look at the aggregate changes in the monetary supply and why is the Fed, and what the Fed is actually doing. Are they actually quantitative tightening? Are they actually rolling off their balance sheet like they said they would? Are they doing what they said they would want to do? And I know a lot of people in the libertarian community don't believe that the Fed is actually doing what they say they're doing. So from there, lay out your argument, and then we'll go from there.
Well, they're definitely tightening credit. So that's not even an issue. I mean, that's published, sure. And they have meetings to tell us about it, and we can see what the target Fed funds interest rate is. The question is, are they really tightening money? And when you look at the Fed balance sheet, you know, what happened, it was below $4 trillion in late 2019. It got just up above $4 trillion right before the pandemic. And then they printed about $3 trillion. And when I say printed, I mean that they bought assets off the market, either treasury bonds or mortgage-backed securities, to the tune of $3 trillion in about 3 months. Mm-hmm. And over the course of the next very recently, they bought another $2 trillion worth of assets, meaning that they increased the money supply, the base money supply, before that money starts getting lended out, by about $5 trillion between late 2019 and mid 2022. So not long ago, that was still going up. And I should point out that according to Mr. Powell, they are still buying assets, but what they are doing is buying them at a rate which would be a net negative for their balance sheet. In other words, they're buying them, but these assets are always being rolled off. They're always being paid off. So money is flowing into the Fed and paying off these bonds that they're holding. Mm-hmm. And as these bonds get paid in full, they disappear. That money is destroyed. Mm-hmm. So it, just so everybody really realizes how many moving parts there are, their stated goal was to decrease their balance sheet by buying slower so that the assets that are being retired outpace the buying. Mm-hmm. And they have done that. I'm not disputing. I'm just disputing that what they've done is significant, because if they printed $5 trillion in 2 years, then you would expect significant to be something more than $200 or $300 billion over the past, when did they start? Supposedly in June, so about 6 months. So the last I checked, when I wrote the article, the balance sheet was at about $8.6 trillion, down from just under $8.9 trillion. So call it $300 trillion.
Right.
Now, I have been paying attention to Golds, Goats, and Guns since I became aware of you, Tom. Mm-hmm. And it took me 2 or 3 months for you screaming about the reverse repo market to finally say, what does he care about that? Oh, my God, it's $2 trillion. So of that $5 trillion, yes, they have tied up only since mid 2021 about $2 trillion of that money. Mm-hmm. And we could get into all that. But basically, that's money that's kind of frozen. It's still officially part of the money supply, but it's constantly being bought. These treasuries are constantly being bought and resold to mm-hmm. kind of keep that money frozen there. And for people who aren't that dialed in on this, just think of it like it's, they put money in a Fed bank account and they're getting interest on yeah, it. For all intents and purposes.
They're anywhere from overnight to 90-day CDs at the Fed.
Right.
For all intents and purposes.
And then a whole bunch went into excess reserves. And I know in my article, I accounted for about how much excess reserves increased.
Mm-hmm.
And I will say that since the peak in November 2021, excess mm-hmm. reserves have come down mm-hmm. By $1 trillion. So a mm-hmm. trillion out of those excess reserves has flowed back into the economy. I'll say excess reserves increased about a trillion. So they're back down to where they were before the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
So excess reserves is not a factor with total quantity of money available. That doesn't mean it's being deployed in one way or another, but it's out there in the money supply. So basically, my argument is that let's just put the reverse repo market aside and say, what if they never even printed that $2 trillion? There's still an extra $3 trillion
mm-hmm.
that wasn't there 2 years ago that is out there.
Well,
that is available.
It's not, it isn't necessarily. Yeah. A lot of it went overseas. A lot of it showed up as we got to remember this is the thing about this. This is where I'm like, I'm with Martin Armstrong on this, which is every time the Fed prints money, every time Congress does something dumb, the Fed gets blamed for it. This is the problem with libertarians. Dead serious. They fundamentally ignore what's going on Capitol Hill because we have it. Because it's not just libertarians. It's newly minted libertarians. It's the ones that all came on board after Ron Paul. And Ron Paul popularized and the Fed buy gold. What are we doing? Sure. But there's two sides to this thing. It's always, and I'm not, again, not being an apologist for the Fed here. Yeah, they should be shrinking their balance sheet faster. But can they shrink their balance sheet faster? This is the question you have to ask, because it's never about the stock of money. Everything you've discussed is about the stock of money. And then you're assuming that money is then out there in the world. If it's not being lent, if it's just sitting there as reserves on bank balance sheets, okay, and they're parking it at the Fed or their excess reserves. So we have the Congress spent an unbelievable amount of money that they raised during COVID that the Fed was forced to monetize, correct? The CARES Act forced $3 trillion worth of reserves onto the Fed's balance sheet. Janet Yellen and Mnuchin, previous to her, had that sitting in a bank account in June of 2021. They had $1.7 trillion in a checking account at Congress that they raised during the CARES Act. And Powell, when he raised the reverse repo rate 5 basis points above the Fed funds rate, drained $1.3 trillion of that. Now, some of that went overseas. About $700 billion from my calculations last summer went between June and Jackson Hole in like 3 months. Half of it went overseas. It's not in our economy. It's not showing up as domestic inflation. There's easily $600 billion in the offshore dollar markets going to, you know, shore up French banks and Credit Suisse or whatever, right? And then maybe about less than $600 billion of that money that the Treasury had and spent actually showed up in the economy. We would have had much worse inflation had the Fed not done what they did, because it's about the flow of money at the margin, not the stock of money that's sitting around.
The money that's not moving
doesn't matter. And for at the margin for prices. See, because that's the thing about this. The stock and flow. And these are two important things. And stock is now being disgorged, right, as you rightly point out. We're starting to see stock. Excess reserves are falling. The reverse repo facility balances are falling. Money is starting to leak back out into the economy. And at higher interest rates, people are paying down, having to pay out more to service their debt than they had in the past. So some of that money is just going out into the economy globally to service debt and then that debt gets destroyed and that money gets destroyed. So this base money is getting turned into credit and then being destroyed.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. And one other little wrinkle, and I had read this somewhere mid 2021, it was probably somebody trying to defend Joe Biden. But regardless of their motivation, I think what they said was true, which is that the Fed printed all this money and the Congress passed all this spending, but the money didn't actually start leaving the Treasury until 2021. And that's why we started to see some price inflation in 2021, a lot more since the November 2021. And I think you could account for that. If you buy that the supply of money has an effect on this, that about $1 trillion came out of excess reserves between 2021 and now. That's all the money that went into excess reserves, by the way, has now come out. And, right.
And it was, and remember that the original balance was created by Bernanke and Yellen during the ZIRP and the ZIRP years. Excess reserves didn't exist before that.
One other thing I just wanted to point out, I think your listeners probably a high percentage know this, but I hear a lot of people talk as if open market operations by the Fed are the same as they were before 2008. So before 2008, when whoever the Bernanke or whomever was before him said, I'm going to raise the Fed funds rate, they actually, when they bought securities off the market, they actually lowered the money supply all in the same operation.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas now they don't do that. Mm-hmm. Now they're just changing the interest that they pay on excess reserves. So they're not removing any money just by raising the rate. This is kind of the first thing I should have said, so I apologize. But
no, it's worth.
I think it's worthwhile for people to think in those terms that you now have two different operations. One raises the interest rate. It discourages money creation by the banks.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one, which is quantitative tightening, which is selling those securities, that's when, of course, we remove base money from the economy. So with everything you said, and being somebody who tries to listen to everybody, including John Tamney, who I mentioned, I think, before we got on, I mean, mm-hmm. he says things like the Fed doesn't matter at all. The supply of money doesn't matter at all. You're saying, no, it's not that it doesn't matter at all, but it does matter what happens once that money hits, you know, the accounts that are measured in M2. And I agree, it does matter.
Insane to think that the flow of money around the world does not matter. Like if you think that, then I'm like, if someone thinks that, then I'm like, okay, well, there are many monetary cranks out there. And I'll just like make it abundantly clear. Like I go back to Gary North when I hear stuff like that. Like if somebody says something that makes no damn sense when it comes to money, they're a monetary crank. And you used to just go through them like and take them down one by one. Great old articles over the archives at Lou Rockwell of him going over, you know, everyone, even people today who are now my patrons. FYI.
All right. So given that that some of that money flowed overseas, did you mention 700 billion?
Yeah, something like that. There was a discrepancy between the amount of I did the math a while ago and I can't quite remember, you know, how but I came to that. It was pretty obvious. I wrote about it in a blog post at some point. So
I guess the last part of it I would say is that M2 increased about $6 trillion
mm-hmm.
with the Fed printing $5 trillion. So we would expect that to be.
It's a low multiplier.
Right. And now it's come down. I mean, it really hasn't come down.
It's coming down. It's going to take a while for that to happen. People are not going to, you know, remember, M2 is checking plus time deposits. Right?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So it's come down to 500.
You know, people are still people are worried about the future. They're not spending money. So M2 was going to be sticky if people are holding on to the savings rate is starting to rise again. So, you know, the savings rate's starting to rise. People are worried about the future. Interest rates are rising. And by the way, their mortgages are, their car loans are going up. Like the amount of money that used to be around, you know, people are going to be paying off debt here. And that's going to change the way the money flows through the economy. So the fact that M2 is even starting to drop off at all is the most, a powerful argument for a deflationary environment. Okay.
Yeah. And
because that's going to be about flow, right? And at some point, it's going to be about flow effectively. because there's going to be less money around to flow through the economy. And therefore, the general pricing level should drop. But the question is, remember, money doesn't flow symmetrically through an environment, through an economy. That's the problem. That's the bigger problem. You know, the Cantillon effect of money creation by the Fed or by any central bank is the big one, right? Now that the Fed has raised rates to 4.5%, likely, in my opinion, going to 7%, and everybody thinks I'm crazy, but it doesn't, you know, I'm actually, when you look at the balance sheet numbers and the M2 numbers that you've pointed out, it only tells me that the Fed's not nearly done trying to get rid of all of this latent inflation that they don't, that they're desperately trying to keep from getting into the economy. And so that's why I keep arguing that it's about the offshore dollar markets and trying to drain them.
Yeah.
At the same time as keep the flow of the domestic within through the domestic economy relatively stable, or at least shrinking slowly while the offshore dollar markets are drained at a greater rate. And then basically all that excess money that's sitting on as reserves. Remember also that all those reserves are also there for the banks in case the banks get in trouble when the interest rates start, when things get hinky, because things are going to get hinky outside of the United States.
So here's my thing, what I was trying to get to the bottom of with mm-hmm. this whole rabbit hole. I'm open to the fact that, you know, that like I said, the Fed doesn't even matter, but I think it does. I think it's more likely that it does.
Mm-hmm.
Not the entire Austrian theory is out the window just because the Fed has complicated things.
Right.
And they've complicated them quite a bit. But why would, if Powell wants to tighten and wants to definancialize our economy, which is part of your theory, I think, is mm-hmm. not just the whole thing with Europe, but he wants to also definancialize and bring our financial markets back in line with what really happens in the real economy.
Where we have this to put that in practical terms, that banks go back to real lending for real yeah. projects, as opposed to taking fake money from the Fed or zero bound and then speculating in the casinos of the futures markets and swaps and, you know, and all of these rehypothecated, increasingly esoteric financial products that have nothing to do with the real economy, and that we need to be, you know, building bridges and, you know, community banks and all the rest of it that actually needs to get done, you know, tool and die shops and all the stuff I talk about all the time. Yes,
exactly. So, and by the way, I heard an interview on Wealthion with Luke Groman,
mm-hmm.
who said the same thing, and my ears perked right up, knowing right. that you and I were going to talk. And I said, right. Oh, I've got to remember to mention that there's some confirmation out there from somebody else. I'm always looking for somebody coming from a different perspective to arrive at the same conclusion, mm-hmm. because that's confirmation, because we can't read minds. We don't know what's in his mind.
Right.
But the idea that Powell tied up money that, but for him changing his interest rate policy on reverse repos, that's a $2 trillion stimulus in very short order, whatever
yeah,
the
no.
length of those contracts are, 2 weeks, 24 hours.
Well, they're anywhere from 24 hours to 90 days, I think. But they can be rolled over. The thing is, I want to go back real quick. I want to go back to the point that you made earlier about the Biden administration not spending the money. And you know why they didn't spend the money? Because they were trying to pass Build Back Better and put another $6.5 trillion worth of spending that the Fed would be forced to monetize. So they held off on spending that money for as long as possible in order to try and keep the quote-unquote deflationary impulse of COVID and COVID lockdowns politically on the table for as long as possible. And Powell outweighed them. And
That's
then, yeah, no, I, absolutely. When you said that, the first thing that popped into my head, because remember, I've been arguing for a long time that Build Back Better was going to be the knockout punch to kill the Fed.
Well, the Trump administration didn't spend it right away either. I mean, they had some of that at their disposal.
No.
I don't know if they had different reasons. Well, obviously, they had different reasons. Whether they had reasons we'd like or not, I don't know. But the Trump administration had a good 4 to 6 months to spend a lot of that money, and mm-hmm. a lot of it didn't go. I don't know if that's process or decision or not.
I don't know. It may have been had to wait until the 2021 budget year, something. I don't know.
Just to get to the end of my little theory there that I don't think really contradicts yours. It might kind of go along with it. I'm wondering whether Powell wants a lot of cash out there in private hands so that at the end game of this, there's somebody to buy all these treasury bonds that are going to be, you know, still forthcoming at least $1 trillion a year. Groman, by the way, said that, and you'd have to watch the interview to see how he arrives at this, but because of some forces that can't really be avoided at this point, he thinks there's going to be a $2.6 trillion deficit next year. And somebody's got to buy those bonds and keep that interest rate in the ballpark. And I'm wondering, that's where I was going with all of that, is Powell thinking, if I have all this money in U.S. domestic private hands, to your point that he's trying to get it out of the euro dollar market, or at least, you know, collapse, pull that down.
He's trying to collapse trying to collapse the leverage within those markets.
Yeah. So is he looking to a future where he's accomplished one goal, but he still has trillions in treasuries coming, you know, from the deficit, and he wants private U.S. domestic banks to soak that up?
Sure.
And keep the interest rate.
And that's why you put the pension funds are in arrears. The bank's going to need high quality collateral. What better high quality collateral is there than U.S. Treasuries paying a 6% coupon? Like, think about, I want you, everybody to think about this one. This is a point I've been trying to make for a while. Go back to pre-COVID. Russian bonds were paying, Russian OFZs were paying, and this is before the Russians were persona non grata, mostly. Russian OFZs were paying around 7 to 8%. The rate, actually, they were paying closer to 9% the 10-year level. They were paying junk bond rates, right? In a world of zero bound interest rates, before the Fed starts raising rates, 9% is a junk bond. It's worse than a junk bond. You can get junk bonds here in the United States for 6, right? Now look at today. Bank of Russia is, you know, under unbelievable financial sanctions. Has almost no, quote unquote, has no market for their debt, supposedly, and is trading, and their rate is exactly the same as it was before COVID at 7.5%. But today, the Fed's at 4.5%. So now ask yourself the question, does that 7.5% really look like a junk bond when the Fed is talking about going to 5.5 or 6? This is the question. Everybody has to kind of recalibrate what they think the cost of money actually is going to be. And what that is, and especially in an environment of 11, 7, 8, 10, 12, 14% inflation. All of a sudden, junk bonds need to be paying 15%, not 7 or 8, right? When new car loans are, I just read something this morning that, you know, that the credit unions are behind the curve in issuing new car loans. They issued them at 6% last month when the commercial banks are issuing them at 8.7 to 9. New car loans. Forget used car loans. Okay? This is the new reality. Like, all of a sudden, everybody has to, with this kind of rate shock, everybody's idea of what it is that they think the cost of money is going to change, which is going to radically change the way they think about what it is they actually spend their money on.
Yeah,
and when you start to do that, when you start to do that analysis, you start to say to yourself, okay, where do I really want to invest my money? Am I really going to put it into a plant in, am I going to put that new plant in Germany? Or am I going to put that new plant in Iowa? That's a good question. Intel is not looking at Germany. They're looking at Italy. I wonder why. Because Giorgio Meloni is not crazy. On the other hand, TSMC is building a 3-nanometer plant for Apple in Arizona. So yes, Tom, you are onto something about where you think this money is going to go. Okay.
Yeah. And I guess the concern I have, though, is that, you know, yes, inflation printing year over year is going down very slightly. And here, by the way, it looks like, just thumb in the wind, ballpark, it's going down about as slightly as the money supply is going down. I'm not saying that's a one-to-one relationship.
Sure.
But the other thing people have to remember, by the way, is when you say, oh, inflation was 8.1 year over year last year, and it's only 7.7 or whatever it was year over year this month. Well, that's because you're comparing it to a higher number. We were in an inflationary, price inflationary environment last year. So every month you're comparing
baseline effects now
today's
worse.
Prices over a higher you know, baseline last year. Yeah.
I agree.
You can make it the inflation hasn't gone down at all. It's just, we're just comparing it to a higher price. Sure. But even if he's certainly not creating new money. And at some point prices adjust, if you believe in the quantity theory of money, to the amount of money that we have, and assuming he doesn't create more, and at a much higher level, prices don't come down, but they do. Yeah. But to me, that's a long, long process. And we've got a long way to go with increasing prices, maybe not at 8%, but 6 is a lot.
Dude,
and we're not near 6.
I think
yet.
We've got another round of double digit inflation coming.
Yeah.
And just to point something else out, because maybe one day Martin Armstrong will actually listen to this, which is to say, you will hear two libertarians now talk about how the quantity theory of money, yes, is in fact a problem, because Keynesians are obsessed with and many Austrians, and I would say many, I don't want to be rude, but many newly minted adolescent, I don't know what the hell the best word for it is, Austrian economists look at the money supply and immediately go, there should be inflation. No, there's the supply and then there's the demand side of money. And even Mises himself said the quantity theory of money has a fundamental problem because it does not address the demand side for money. Okay? Money is a commodity like anything else. And this is, Martin Armstrong's made this point about the quantity theory of money. He bangs his shoe on the table like Khrushchev about it all damn day long. He also uses it as a bludgeon to invalidate, you know, all of Austrian economics, which is, I think he's overstating that case. But that's Martin. That's who he is. That's fine. Can't begrudge him that. It's not like I don't overstate shit, right? So, like, I glass houses and pots and kettles and all that stuff. So, but understand that this is the part that we have to get better at in our analysis of this, is that, and that's why I keep bringing up slack versus flow, and that there's two sides to the demand for money. Okay. Powell has a bigger problem than just the size of the amount of money that he's sequestered, or effectively what they call sterilized, right? The original rate tranche of QE from Bernanke, he sterilized with interest on excess reserves. And everybody was doing the exact same thing that you're doing today. Why didn't we get all this inflation? Well, because he was paying 25 basis points over the Fed funds rate. And the banks knew they couldn't go and get 50 basis points in the market. So they parked them with the Fed. And the Fed recapitalized the banks through interest on excess reserves. So now we're in the same situation, except he's using the reverse repo facility.
And let me just say one thing real fast, is that the QE you're talking about after the 2008 financial crisis, mm-hmm. a much larger percentage of that went into excess reserves than this last round.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say 2.7 out of 3 trillion of it or something.
Oh yeah. It all just went. And Gary North said this directly. I can bring up Dr. North, the late great Gary North. He called this right down the line. He said, we're not going to see that. At best, we are going to see stagflation, which is effectively what we saw. And, he was right. And he said, look, Bernanke's not going to let the money flow. If the money doesn't flow, it's not going to cause inflation. And that's exactly what happened. And Powell, when the Treasury was about ready to start spending all that money, Powell did the same thing by not letting the money flow, by giving the banks a way to pull money out of the economy. He wasn't able to stop all of it because it was just too much. But that was the Davos plan, to destroy the credibility of the Fed and then, you know, force even the Fed to default along with everybody else, because that was their plan.
And one other data point, I know I there's so many moving parts. Again, mm-hmm. I'm trying to watch them all too.
Sure.
September of 2014, there's 2.8 trillion in excess reserves.
Mm-hmm.
It takes until October of 2019 to get $1.3 trillion out of there.
Yep.
For it to flow out of there. This mm-hmm. time around, $1 trillion has flowed out in basically the past year.
Yep.
So it's flowing out much faster. There's more money we're talking about here. And it's not like we have that bigger a population, economy, production, whatever. So, I mean, these are just tidal waves. And of course, he's answering with this crazy rate hike thing. And I guess the one of the points I wanted to make with the article was, because I hear people say, talk as if he's decreasing the money supply like that, and he's not. So,
well, no, I appreciated that nuance that you put it, that nuance you put on it, which is to say, yes, there's new ways of creating the Fed doing open market operations for all intents and purposes. Now it's not the old system. And it's a point that I've been kind of making, you know, like in this environment, Powell has the same tools, but different. They have different names, but they're the same tools that Bernanke used in 2008. Now, except that Powell wants to, because he's got a massive stock on both sides of the balance sheet. He's got over $2 trillion in reverse repos as cash, and he's got mortgage, and he's got all these securities that he could sell into the market if he needs to. Okay, whatever the market needs in a liquidity crisis, collateral or money, he can provide. Okay, that's the point of this. Whereas what Bernanke did in 2008 was to just provide collateral to the banks. This way, Powell can play both sides of the equation. He has fine control over the foreign and domestic dollar flow with these facilities that he didn't have, that Bernanke didn't have or didn't want in 2008. Because Bernanke was a vandal like Yellen and Geithner and Obama. They were just literally trying to destroy the Fed. I don't give a shit what anybody says at this point. Fuck Bernanke. He's not man of the year, except for Davos. Like, let's destroy humanity, and this is how we're going to do it. And Powell went, and we're listening to Daniel DiMartino Booth recently, which he pointed out that when Bernanke created the 2% inflation target out of whole cloth, well, Powell was a junior member of the FOMC board going, what the fuck you doing? Where did that come from? Show me in the charter where you can do that. And Bernanke just did it. And he did it because he was a globalist intent on destroying the validity of the Fed. And he knew exactly what he was doing. So of course they gave him, you know, the Nobel Prize in economics and, you know, all this stuff. Like, of course, because he's doing exactly what they want him to do. And now Powell's trying to take this mess that they've created. And I think he's just trying to unwind it. And then we as Austrians and as libertarians get lost in our critique of central banking to see how the Fed gets out of this mess. Because the Fed has to if the Fed wants to survive. And that's the important part.
Let's revisit one other thing we alluded to real early, and we've kind of, this is another wrinkle that now complicates us even more, which is that $8.6 trillion in Treasury and bonds and mortgage-backed securities, at least the Treasury bonds, are not worth whatever they were worth when the Fed bought them. Because if they bought them with a coupon rate of, you know, 1%, and now they're being issued at 4, I mean, they can't sell them back to the banks. And this is one thing I'm not sure about. You may know this, I don't. If they really wanted to sell the securities and not just let them roll off, can they force the banks to take them at face value, or do they have to sell them at the market price?
Yeah, so they can't sell them at the market price. No, well, so the thing is, that's the other question. And again, it depends on what the series is, depends on the CUSIPs and all that stuff. And like, yeah, I don't know. But does the Fed own 30% of the 70% of the 10 and 30 year bond market? This is what my point I keep making. The QE3 had to end because statutorily the Fed wasn't allowed to buy any more US 10 years. They were at 70% of the total issuance. They bought it all. Right? They weren't allowed, and they couldn't buy any more of it. So that's why QE finally ended, by the way. Same thing, I think, in the 30 years. I don't know if they ever got up to 70% in the 30 years. A more diligent Fed watcher than me would know that number. But they own a tremendous amount of long-dated securities. That's where most of their portfolio is. It's also, if you notice, if you haven't noticed, it's also where the market wants to buy collateral at this point. Go look at the 210 spread. Even though I keep saying Powell wants to raise, you know, that he wants to get back to an upward sloping yield curve. I've been saying, like, I'll be interested to see what happens in the March numbers. Remember, as we said at the beginning of this, the Fed sells a security in December. We won't show up on the balance sheet until March. So it'll be very interesting to see during this rally that we've had, this massive rally in U.S. 10-years that happened over the last month, from 4.25% back to 3.4%, 80 basis points in like a three-week period. Was the Fed dumping a whole lot of U.S. 10 and 30 years into that market? Did they dump $50 billion of them into the market at a profit? It's a good question. Like everybody else, like other central banks buy and sell U.S. treasuries, right? In order to manage, in order to reload, and just they reload and disgorge in order to be able to defend their currencies. So when the U.S. debt falls too quickly, central banks just step in and they buy. And they buy, why? Because they're reloading for the next time when they're going to need to disgorge them to defend their currency when some other crisis hits the market. And so this process is just slow and complicated. And there's literally billions of people with their agendas focused on this market. So it's just fascinating that you have to think about all those vectors when we're assessing all this stuff. I watched the long end of the yield curve at this point, and I said a couple of weeks ago, I said, you know, let's see if the Fed put finally leaves people's thinking. If the 210 spread starts to narrow, which we've seen over the last couple of weeks, maybe that's the final, that's another tranche of people that finally woke up and went, oh my God, the Fed actually is not going to pivot. Oh no. And now they're out there, you know, selling 10 years. But I mean, the Treasury just had two great auctions to end the year, Tom. The 2 and the 7 went off great.
One theory I heard, and I wish I could remember whether it was Grohman or David Rosenberg, it was one of the two, and I can't remember which one it was saying that whole rally was actually the Fed throwing a lifeline to what they called Team USA, which wouldn't just include Europe, but it would include Japan. In the whole idea that, like, look, if you want there to be a Team USA against Russia and China, you can't kill us. I know you think they definitely want to kill
Europe. That sounds like Luke Roman, to be honest with you. It sounds like Luke, and I like Luke, and I think he's a very smart guy. I think he should, and I, at the same time, I really hate to say this the way I'm going to say it, but he should stay in his lane. He should stay in his lane. Geopolitics is not his strong suit. That is not what the Fed did. Why? The Fed, if anything, was allowing the markets, I think, allowing the Eurodollar markets and allowing the markets to absorb what happened in Europe in September when Davos executed a coup against the UK, against the Bank of England, and then tried to take out Credit Suisse. And the Fed and the SNB had to buy. But I think the SNB was the one out there really. It was the Fed and the SNB trying to bail out Credit Suisse. And other forces were all aligning, and I think that has what created this honeymoon period for the ECB, why the euro is trading at $1.06, and but at the same time, as I've been saying, Lagarde can protect the euro, or she can protect credit spreads, but she can't protect both.
Yeah,
not for more than 24 hours at a time. So,
it's interesting because a lot of those people that are on our side of the football field, mm-hmm. but they're still been saying, oh, here comes the pivot. Here comes the pivot. I'm starting to hear some doubt. Maybe there won't be a pivot. Maybe it's not till way next year. And every time a meeting comes up, I gotta admit that I'm thinking of you the minute he walks to the podium, and I'm pretty confident he's going to say something nasty. And so far he always does. So hats off to you on that.
The thing is, Tom, and I, again, I'm not here to bust my hand, pat myself on the back or anything. I don't really care about that. When you stop and really think about what's going on, the rate of de-dollarization that's occurring go back to Martin Armstrong. There are more hundreds in bank accounts overseas, in cash, than there are singles in circulation. And they're all overseas. Okay? Singles, they move domestically. Fives, tens, singles, they move domestically. 20s, hundreds are what people save dollars in. And when you think about the amount of cash that exists, whether it was CIA, you know, based or, you know, created or not, or spent or not, when you think about those pallets of cash that are out there, metaphorically speaking, they're all going to come home as these countries de-dollarize, as the Biden administration, you know, continues to ratchet up the war rhetoric and radicalize and force people out of, and the more, and I've been arguing for 3 years, like the more that we weaponize the dollar, going even back to Trump, screaming at him about sanctions, you're weaponizing the dollar, you're forcing de-dollarization, you're forcing now a massive inflation problem on the future of America. You can't, we can't stop that, because at some point you can't destroy the money fast enough, which is kind of the point that you've been making the entire, you know, that's really the point you're making, is that we can't destroy the money fast enough. And, you know, that's where the argument between hard landing, soft landing, or is there even an argument about hard landing versus soft landing? It's a good question.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm always looking for some kind of confirmation of what the motivation might be. And it's just impossible. I mean, I think your theory is as plausible. It's more plausible than any other one I've heard. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, though, that we have to always remember is, just because that's the motivation doesn't mean that these people are good at what they're doing or that they're going to be successful.
Right.
There's kind of an analogy to this whole libertarian kerfluffle about immigration. And the one thing I haven't heard since libertarians started talking about immigration is, can the government stop it, even if it tries its hardest? History says mass migrations over land. No, you can't. You can do everything you can to slow it down. You can't stop it. Armies can be stopped because they come in a formation. They're all dressed alike, right? You know, but a government, the worst organization on earth, is never going to stop a mass migration. And I don't think they're going to accomplish whatever they're trying to do here. The only thing is they're up against other governments. So it's very, it's like we're living in a, like, you know, like when the Enterprise goes out of the galaxy and there's like no reference points. That's kind of how I feel.
We're in Brazil.
And I'm always
The bureaucracy written. It's just the bureaucracy out of control. Yeah. I don't know. I never argue from a position that the people who are in charge of anything are fundamentally incompetent. I understand that governments as organizations are incompetent because of the bureaucracy of the competing agendas, of the corruption, of the this or that. That I get. Never get me to. And so, in a big macro sense, yes, this is where the libertarian criticisms of these systems are absolutely trenchant, spot on, and powerful. But the way we get there, the order of operations matters. The incentives of the people who are actually pulling the levers matter. As much as we hate to admit that, because we don't want to admit it, because then we have to admit that we actually have to work now. I can't just buy gold. I can't just stack sats, stack gold, and go play with my kids, you know, and be dismissive of everybody who's being, you know, it's like hardcore libertarians on that front are no different than hardcore communists. They just they get all intellectual. They smoke cigarettes and put on the beret and they do the thing. And then they argue amongst themselves and no one actually ever gives you a fucking answer that it's worth the shit. And I get it. Like, I get it completely. And this is one of the things I've been trying to pound in everybody. No, we all have to get better at this. Because the Fed has a motivation to live. It's an organization. The first rule of any organization is self-preservation. So is the banks. So is the old neocolonialists. So are the neocons. So are all of these factions. Everybody. And everybody is going to assess the game board at that moment in time and go, what's my best play? And if you're thinking that they're morons and they're not going to act in their own best interest when they're under existential threat of destruction, well, then you're a bad fucking analyst and you should shut the fuck up. Is literally the way I want to scream at people at this point. Just shut up. You're just dumb. Like, no. And this is why I get angry with guys like Peter Schiff, because he just keeps saying the same goddamn thing every day. Pisses me off.
No, I agree with all that. And, you know, the only caveat I would say is, you know, the Soviet government had a self-preservation instinct. The Federalists and Whig parties here in America had self-preservation. Sometimes it doesn't work.
Of course.
But that being said, also, you know, here's my problem with Ayn Rand. That sounds like it's coming out of left field, but I don't actually believe the people in the government are any better or worse than the people in the private sector.
No.
And with Ayn Rand, it always seemed like these are the bad people and these are the creators and the good people. If you read her carefully, it's actually there's enough caveats in there that's not exactly what she's saying, but if you read her generally, that's the feeling you come away with. No, I believe in the market because I believe people are capable of good and evil and competence and incompetence. And the only thing that checks incompetence and evil is the threat of starving, going out of business, you know, whatever, losing your house, some kind of check on some kind of accountability. And, you know, to me, the problem with the status is they don't recognize that making a law does not introduce accountability.
No,
it's not a check. Mm-hmm. How many thousands of years of proof do we need that it doesn't work?
It's the biggest problem. The status believe that they believe what you just said, when the reality is that all they've done is created another vector for corruption. They've created another limit at which somebody, it's written in law, I can scam somebody else until this point. At that point, I'm breaking the law. At this point, I'm not. Every law reads that way. Every law is the speed limit. At the end of the day, you're at 55 miles an hour, and that's the posted speed limit. You're not breaking the law. You're at 56. You're breaking the law. Every law works that way.
Yeah.
And everybody's behavior is going to move right to that level. Because that's where they're getting maximal advantage, taking advantage of that rule. And that's the part that no statist ever wants to argue, ever wants to deal with. And I don't care if they're right-wing statists or left-wing statists. They all refuse. I fundamentally believe they all refuse this. They all say, well, that's nice, but we have these practical problems that we have to deal with right now. I'm like, that's nice. So now you're setting other systems in motion that I'm going to have to come back and critique and fix fucking 30 years from now. Nice. Thanks a lot. Appreciate that. I know what industry I need to go invest in now. Like, you know, it's like, but then that's why central banking is fundamentally flawed, obviously, but it's why the difference between a minarchist and an anarchist, if properly applied, is 2 years.
Yeah. Took me 12, but I'm not as smart as most of these libertarians. So,
fine, fair enough. It doesn't matter. Eventually, you get there. It's an average. It's a thing. It's a 2 years. You know, you
can call it 5,
whatever. It was 2 years for me.
Well, and the reason I go down this is that regardless of Jay Powell's motivations, mm-hmm. I mean, and this is funny that you bring up the status mindset. When you get an argument with one, and anyone who hasn't noticed this already, notice this. When they try to push back, the first thing they'll say is, no, you don't understand what we're trying to do is. No, I do understand what you're trying to do. Here's your pat on the head. Okay, you're a good person. That's what you're looking for, right?
Right.
Because I'm paying attention to what you're doing, not what you're trying to do.
Right.
And what people trying to do what you were trying to do have done in the past and the results. And they're always terrible. And, you know, Powell could be doing exactly what you're saying. This has so many ways to blow up, not the way he wants it to, if that's what he wants. That's kind of where I'm going to with all this money floating around.
Yeah. But here's the thing. As libertarians, we understand that they printed too much money. We understand that there's too much credit running around, that the cost of money is too low. It perverted the society. It's perverted our ethics, our values, our morals, our institutions and everything. And it's turbocharged it to the point now where we think it's okay to that for 6-year-olds without parental consent to mutilate themselves. And we have to lay that at the feet of Bernanke and Yellen and Lagarde and Kuroda and every other damn shitty central banker around the world, because that's what they did. Then again, we also let them do it. So who's really at fault here? So now I got Powell raising rates like you wouldn't believe in the core economy of the world to try and break the excessively aberrant behavior brought on from 15 years of zero bound interest rates. I'm on Team Powell, even if he breaks things that we could have avoided breaking, right? But so what? So many other things are already broken that need to be repaired. Like, I'm okay with breaking a few things at this point, a few other things, because other things need to be repaired and will be getting repaired, because they're going to get the proper amount of capital, because we're going to be properly assessing risk, getting closer to the actual risk of investment.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, but I think, you know, nobody should be owning a mortgage. 30-year mortgages are an aberration. We're all used to it, thanks to the FDR and FHA and Fannie and Freddie and all that. But honestly, 10-year mortgages and 2-year car loans, that's what we should be looking at. We got to get back to that. We have to get back to that mindset that's what the average needs to be. And that the 30-year mortgage is an aberration. The 5-year car loan is an aberration. And there we are.
Yeah, it's funny how used to things like that you get. I mean, I remember when the 5-year car loan was, what, really?
Me too.
5 years? What about 3, right? So I did get a 5-year car loan, the first car I bought in like 1987, right, I think. And my parents were saying, that's a long time to owe money to a bank. Mm-hmm. You know?
I remember the first time my dad got a 4-year or 5-year loan on a car. He was like, never again, ever will I do this. And he was seriously not happy about it. By that point, he was old enough that he was basically buying his cars with cash at that point. He didn't have to buy a loan against his cars. And he was in his mid-50s at that point and retired. He had plenty of money to just go buy a car every 3 or 4 years. So he didn't do that. But that was the last one. And he bought it. Yeah, he was like, no, never again. Never again.
In your theory, is there ever another bailout, or is it because of all these excess reserves, we won't get to that point?
That's a good question, Tom, and I don't have a good answer for it. I just know that Powell has accumulated a big war chest, and then we'll see. Will there be bailouts of the banks? Probably.
Yeah.
Well, banks, you know, we're starting to see smaller banks. Somebody asked me the other day about this, and I think it was, I don't remember who it was. It was Alex Craner. I was on with Sean Newman, and Alex opened with, hey, I'm seeing, you know, there's some banks going to the Fed discount window now, which is usually the market, which is like the walk of shame. That's like the scarlet letter of banking, right? To actually go to the discount window as opposed to, like, you know, play hinky and go to the reverse repo window or some other thing. It's like they'll do everything imaginable to avoid going to the discount window to get money. And that story ran around for a couple of days, but the truth of the matter is that it was mostly banks with very little capital. So it was more effective and cheaper for them to go to the Fed discount window. These were very small banks, not a big deal, less than $1 billion in assets, that kind of thing. So basically community banks, maybe small credit unions or whatever. As long as that stays, as long as those conditions stay at that level, I think we're, you know, the longer that we stay at that level where there's no major banks or G-SIBs, right, then, you know, we're okay for now. And I think as long as we see that and we continue to see markets refuse to admit that the Fed doesn't want to have their back anymore, I think Powell keeps raising rates. I don't know that he keeps raising rates at the rate that I think he's going to raise rates, right? I'm on record now. I think 440, 450s and 425s in 2023. We've had our first 50. We'll have 3 more, and then we'll have 425s, and we'll be at a terminal rate of 7%. Bullard's already out there saying the terminal rate will be between 5 and 7%. It was the first time anybody mentioned 7%. That's the Fed's way of saying, oh yeah, we're going to 7. Now, again, I could be wrong.
Yeah.
But even the Eurodollar futures market is now talking about a Fed pivot at 5.1% as opposed to 4.8%. It's moved out. You know, they still think the Fed's going to pivot in June, but, you know, by June, But, you know, they think they're now even the euro dollar futures market is talking 5%. These markets are massively mispriced.
Yeah. You know, what I never would have thought of before I started getting into your stuff is that if we get to a point where it's a Lehman Brothers, it would be interesting to see if the decision to bail out or not to bail out depends on where all the counterparty risk is.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's the bad guys or the guys that Team Powell, whatever, would like to see
right.
still around.
Right.
You know, we'll have to wait. It's next year, maybe. We'll see if we get to those kinds
I don't
of
know that
levels.
It's going to be our. I don't know that it's going to be us. I think it's Europe first.
Yeah.
I just think it's that. Europe first. And again, if I wind up being wrong about this, or if somehow Lagarde is able to, you know, keep this thing running long enough and we get a betrayal at the political level that's so complete here in the United States, that's the big risk. The big risk for the United States at this point is, you know, the Davosians, Davos lieutenants that are currently in charge continue to have control over things post the next Congress being set. Remember, we're all still doing this, and this is a transition. This is the old guard. Remember, there's going to be a lot of changeover after January, whatever 20th or whatever the day is, right? Third week in January. Everything's going to change, right? Joe Manchin could flip to the GOP, and all of a sudden everything is different.
Yeah. I mean, the GOP will have Congress. It doesn't matter if it's by one vote. They can do a lot of things with those committees. I'm not, you know, we could get into a side argument whether they should even have subpoena power, but in the real world here, they could do a lot. I'm just waiting for them to do nothing. I'm waiting for them to just, you know,
again, that should be your default case. The yeah. idea that the past is prologue, right?
Yeah. But I mean, I'm waiting to be disappointed, in other words. But
yeah,
we'll see.
I agree. I agree with you completely. Yeah. But at the same time, like, I seeing a lot of signs here that revolution that the Q-tards kept talking about while Trump was in power, I think we're now actually at that moment where real moves are being made. That's what I see. And those real moves are, and again, FTX, you know, this feels different this time, but everybody's so beaten down because we have no faith, which is exactly what Davos wants us to believe, that the system is terminally corrupt. We don't have to believe that the system is terminally corrupt. We can believe otherwise. It's hard. It sucks. You keep getting your teeth kicked in, but we can do it, right? And if we continue to do that, no, we are going to reassert the rule of law in this country. We are going to reassert our, you know, whatever it is. We're going to show the world that we're not terminally corrupt. And if we do that, the world will be happy with us. That's what the world wants. That's what the world is begging from the United States at this point. That's what the Russians, the Iranians, the Chinese, the only ones not rooting for that are the Europeans. That's your tell. The Europeans want to blame us for everything. They want to tear us down.
Yeah, it's funny because when you hear some of the stuff coming out of the Russian government and some of these other supposed adversaries, it's all pretty good stuff. It's like they'll say, well, those are just Russian talking points. Well, yeah, the Russian talking points sound better than yours. Because they're talking more like classical liberals than anybody on, you know, from Rome West. I know that's a Russian talking point, right? But okay, whatever.
This is where I think it's funny. I don't see the Russians pushing. I may be wrong about this, but I see the Chinese working in hand in glove with the Europeans to destabilize the United States. I'm sure that the Russians are doing their part because they know they're at war with us, right? But they also know that they're at war with our government, not with our people. Putin makes that distinction very clearly. Okay.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a very complicated thing here. And I, you know, to me, the level of histrionics about, quote, you know, about the way the Russian propaganda works. Yeah, it's just not buying that. It's, I mean, it's sophisticated, but it's not, you know, it's not what they're, you know, what we're, the big elephant in the room, which is our own media doesn't work for us. Our own government doesn't work for us. Our own government, they're all bought and paid for by other people, and they're certainly not bought and paid for by the Russians. Like, yeah, there's evidence of the Russians trying to move the narrative in a particular direction. Fine. But how effective is that really compared to what we're seeing out of Bellingcat and the New York Times and, you know, the Mossad and MI6 and all the rest of these people? Like, the Chinese, you know, our own neoconservatives, our own, you know, eggheads on K Street and all the rest of it. I'm like, come on. Like, that's what's really driving the narrative here. And I think everything else is just, you know, paranoia. But that's just my personal opinion on that.
No, it's like when, you know, the media says, here's a true statement. Children are dying of COVID. Okay. Yeah, that's true. Like, statistically, it's zero. It's such a small amount. And I always tell that to everybody when they talk about Russian propaganda affecting the election, climate change, all of these narratives. There's some tiny little technically defendable point in there, but you are being manipulated on such a massive scale. If I said children are dying of COVID, most people would assume that means a lot of children, a big percentage, something so significant we should do something about it.
Right.
Not that we shouldn't do something about one child, but you know what I mean. So, yeah.
But do we motivate an entire country to move to that child, or do we allow the local community to deal with it?
Put it this way, we're doing a lot more to get rid of Putin over in Russian elections than Putin can possibly is capable of doing to us. And Biden and Putin are still in charge. So there you have it.
There you go. Yeah, we still have Biden in charge. And I use that with air quotes.
Yeah, I should have put quotes up here.
Always put quotes around Biden because he's not, you know, the fungus does not make decisions. It's like the first fungal president. So true. Makes me so sad to say that. But it is what it is. I don't know. To bring this all the way back around, back to Powell and the Fed and all this stuff. Yeah. Whether or not they've got the right tools, whether that they've got the right, you know, whether they got the time, whether they have the resources, I don't know. But I can clearly see what they're trying to do. And I also know that everybody's going to bitch at them no matter what they do. Because most people who are bitching about the Fed at this point are talking their book. They're not talking they're just talking their book. If they're an Austrian and a libertarian, they're talking their book about, you know, how central banking is evil and I'm going to pick on the Fed. And if they're, you know, and if they're a freaking hedge fund, they're a freaking hedge fund manager that's upside down by, you know, 25%, they're going to be talking their book. Like, this is the way it is. And I'm like, I'm so over people just talking their book. I don't know if I'm right about any of this, but I know I'm not talking my book. Like, I know gold's going to $10,000 an ounce or $8,000 an ounce or some damn number at some point in the future. I don't care. Like, but I'm still invested in dollars because that's how I get paid.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that's the thing at this point. And I'm not putting my money in anything, honestly, at this point, except, like, you know, gold and commodities, because we're going to have another wave of commodity inflation. So clearly already embedded in the numbers. Like, do you think oil is going to $50 a barrel? I got news for you. Oil is going to $150 a barrel. And if oil goes $150 a barrel, do you think copper is going to stay at $380 a pound? If you do, you're kind of dumb.
Yeah.
Because oil is the biggest input into copper production. Just saying.
Yeah, I think the energy situation, which is a subject for another podcast, is that no matter what the motivations of anybody is, I think that's scary for the future. So,
yeah, I mean, do you think Powell can inflate, can stop doing the job he's doing, knowing that there's another round of commodity inflation coming? Do you think he can do that? I don't. I think he's got to go to 7% for that alone.
Yeah, and that one thing you brought up too that I never really knew. I always assumed Powell was just another economist. And when he started acting off script, I'm like, what's going on with this guy? You know, and I never even knew he was a Wall Street guy. He's a lawyer. He's not even an economist. Now that I know even more, he's always been a hawk. Even back in the Obama days, way when he first started with the bank. So, you know, there's a lot to this guy. I think a lot of people, and especially when you've got a simplistic view, you just say, oh, he's a Fed chairman. He's a Keynesian. He's a whatever. I don't know if he's a Keynesian or a monetarist or what he is.
Whatever.
I'm sure he's not an Austrian.
No.
But he doesn't necessarily have to be, Ben Bernanke or Janet Yellen either.
Right. Right. Private equity Powell. When I first started going down this route, and I got asked, I started asking my community what I thought, what they thought. And they're like, they don't call him private equity Powell for nothing. That's simple. He's from a private equity background. You can call that an asset or a liability. I don't give a shit. Well, what's important is to understand that he's actually put risk capital at risk. Right? Like he's actually moved money around and invested money. The only thing Bernanke and Yellen have ever done is taken ill-gotten gains, their government fucking salaries, your tax money that they stole from you, their entire fucking lives, and then played with it for the purposes of their ideologically blind globalist masters. I'm sorry, but I'll take Jay Powell and his private equity background any day of the week. And any of the anti-capitalists in the audience that might actually be listening to this podcast, you can go fuck yourself. You think that is a better, that you think that we're better off with Bernanke, Yellen, Lagarde, or the rest of them? I'm dead serious. At this point, get over your ideology. This is an ideological fight between the private formation of capital and the public formation of capital. And we all know what the public formation of capital looks like. It is not public. It is not formation. It is destruction. We've got hundreds of years of human history that tells us that when the government gets control over the means of production, they kill a lot of people. Capital doesn't exist without people.
One thing we thought, you know, we wouldn't have to argue anymore, but we do. I mean, heck, we're back to, you know, 17th century mercantilism now with the tariffs. It just never goes away.
No, it never does because it's mercantilism is actually the primary tool of tyrants.
Yeah.
This is very effective. Yep, it is. Tom, this has been great. It's been fun.
Yeah.
You got anything else you want to talk about before we get out the door?
No, I'll just tell you, I'm like I said, I'm always thinking of you when Powell marches up to the microphone, and I'll give you another pat on the back. Boy, the Dow does look different than the S&P and the NASDAQ, doesn't it?
I mean, looks it different than the
none
DAX.
None of them look good, but it looks
different than the DAX and the FTSE and the CAC 40 and a variety of others too. Not as different. A friend of mine, one of my patrons pointed it out to me the other day that, you know, the DAX has been mirroring the performance of the Dow. I said, yeah, except that technically speaking, the Dow is in a much better position than the DAX is. And so at the first sign of trouble, the German DAX is going to collapse and the Dow will probably hold up, or if not, increase a little bit. But the relative performance of the Dow versus the DAX is built into the technical position of both indices as we end this year. And I really should do an end of the year podcast on just the state of markets. I haven't even thought
about it. And I think even a normie might say, well, yeah, the US is a stronger horse in the glue factory than there. But it's really interesting to me to see the difference in the charts between the S&P and mm-hmm. the Dow.
Yeah,
because those are lockstep going back decades, but not anymore.
No, and Martin Armstrong I give Martin credit on that one. He's like, just when he said, you know, if you look at the way the three indices are, they're viewed. The NASDAQ is your quote unquote growth stock. Your S&P 500 is your domestic focused investor. The domestic market, domestic investors look at the S&P because it's a broad swath of the American economy. And then the Dow Jones is looked at as the big pool of liquidity for international investors. And because the deepest, most liquid constant, collection of U.S. stocks. And I think that's a good, and you know, I remember reading that from him, I don't know, 10 years ago. I'm like, oh, yeah, that makes perfect sense. And then all of a sudden, when I finally admitted that I was wrong about the quantity theory of money and a variety of other things, you know, had to really get and start doing the nuanced dive into this stuff. And that was, for me, around 2014, 2015. That's when my perspective on the world changed and my perspective on the markets changed. And I started, and then it took me another 7 years worth of, or 5 years worth of learning again and unlearning what I thought I knew to learn what I think I know now. So, and I think that that's the big thing, is to constantly do what you're currently, you know, I wanted to push you a little bit this morning on what you wrote, you know, what you sent to me, not because, you know, I need to make myself look good, but to push, because if we push each other a little bit, that's when we all get better. You know what I mean? That's how, and I expect people to push it back on me, and I, you know, and I will push back when and where I can, hopefully gently, and we'll go from there. Because that's the point of this. We have to improve. We have to become a better group of analysts to give people better information and better guidance as to where we're going. And that's like my ethos, and I know it is yours as well. So I appreciate you taking the time out this morning.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun, and hey, I think we've got a new year tomorrow, so let's hope it's happy some way. I think there's going to be a lot of pain, but maybe there's some happiness in the pain.
Well, hopefully it's going to be it'll be the worst of the years. I think that's the best we can ask for. Maybe that'll be the 2023 I'm looking at is maybe the bottom, and then from there, you know, we can start to crawl out, you know, crawl from the wreckage, as it were. But I don't know that everything's going to collapse in 2023. It may take another 2 or 3 years. So
yeah,
you can only hope.
We'll see.
All right, Tom, I'm going to run and thank you very much. And plug your podcast, dude, before you get out the door.
Oh yeah. I've got a podcast called Tom Mullen Talks Freedom at tommullentalksfreedom.com. So consider subscribing and listening in.
Yep. I've been on it a couple of times. Tom is a very gracious host, probably more gracious than I am. And we'll go from there. So Tom, you be well, you take care, and we'll talk soon.
All right.
Be well. Well, that'll about put a bow on episode 126 of the Gold, Goats, and Guns podcast. Thank you for listening, as always. And I do actually want to say as well, we're putting a bow on 2022 as well, right? So I do want to thank everybody for listening in this year. We saw really solid growth in both the podcast and the entire Gold, Goats, and Guns platform, and I'm really appreciative of it. If I have a New Year's resolution for 2023 going forward is, well, kind of more of the same. I don't know about you guys, but it was a crazy year, and it was an intense year, and I don't think 2023 is going to be any less crazy or less intense. And thank you for allowing me the opportunity to go through it with you. So you guys be well, you take care, we'll talk soon. Keep your stick on the ice.